all of the time. And so on Handmade Hero, one of the things that I get asked all the time, like all the time, is about network programming. And people are like, are we gonna do networking? Are we gonna do networking? And my answer is always, no, we're not gonna do networking, because I am like the last person you should ask about network programming. Like, I've literally never shipped a piece of code in anything that does networking. Like, my experience in networking is like internal tools only, and I shudder to think what would have happened to these tools if they had been deployed in the wild. I'm sure they would break like immediately. And so what I wanted to do for this session was to sort of get the person who I thought knew absolutely the most about game networking to sort of fill that in whatever we can do in an hour, to sort of answer those questions where it's like, everyone wants to know more about this, so maybe I felt like we could get a perspective on it. So Pat Wyatt is somebody who's, like I think I said this on the actual diagram, he's the person I think of who had the only network game that like shipped with like no problem somehow. Like it was like perfect, and that was Guild Wars, and it was just this, it was this like amazing feat of engineering that it actually had the launch that it did. And because basically everything else at that time was just like, oh yeah, the day that they launched the game, like World of Warcraft, the server immediately goes down or whatever else happened. And so I was like, he had plenty of experience with it working on previous titles on Warcraft and on Diablo. And then when he went to do Guild Wars, that was kind of like the nth generation of his network coding. So I was hoping I could sort of get at some of that knowledge and have him give us an overview of like, what does it take to ship these games that are played by like, you know, literally millions of people, and how do you go about designing it? So please give a warm welcome to Mr. Pat Wyatt. Thank you. All right, so give people some context here, because this was something that that I was kind of curious about as well. Like, the first network game you worked on, was it Warcraft?
No, actually it was...
Was there one before that?
Battle Chess. So I ported Battle Chess from... There's a DOS and Amiga version, and I did the Windows 3.0 version. It was on modem, of course.
Okay, so this is a modem version of Battle Chess, was your first experience with network programming.
That's right.
Okay, so Warcraft was actually like a second generation thing in some sense. You'd already had some experience, and this was before the internet, for the most part, was used in gaming, I believe, right?
That's right.
Local network only. So tell me a little bit about that development process. Like, what was it like, how did you guys go about doing that network development? So, because I don't even know like what was involved at that time.
Yeah, well, so because the internet didn't exist, I sort of had to invent the whole idea of how this would be done whole cloth. And one of the first, immediately obvious things was we had about, 600 units that were gonna be running around in the game. And when I started working out the math of like, well, if every unit's sending its orders of what it's doing all the time, then we're just gonna totally saturate our 2400 baud modem.
2400 baud modem.
That's right.
Okay.
And so it was immediately obvious it was an impractical solution to try and send what each unit was doing. And so I'm not sure exactly how I came up with it, but I figured that what I would do is instead just send the processed user input. So when the user clicked on a map, then I would send, well, he clicked here and he had these units selected, go tell those units to do that. And so both computers would work in lockstep with each other, so that you only had to send the processed input, which is very, very tiny. In fact, you can fit, like a 300 baud modem or something would do the job.
And so for those synchronous models, right, obviously the latency becomes a bit of an issue potentially, no? I mean, like, so how did you guys, Warcraft obviously being a real-time strategy game isn't the most Twitch-oriented, but it's still real-time response. So how did that play out in the code?
So actually it's really interesting. So RTSs by and large are not very twitchy.
Yeah.
Because what happens is you're busy giving so many different orders at the same time that you don't really need to see the action take effect instantaneously. So in the single player version, there's actually no delay. You click on a unit and immediately it starts executing the action. But in the multiplayer version, we have like it's a tunable parameter for some of the earlier games, and we just set it to a hard-coded value in later versions. But basically you say, you go to this, and it's like, yes, my liege. And then it starts going. Right, and it's because like what happens is you send the order out, and you have several packets in flight, and everybody's got these packets in flight all the time, and so it takes a while for that to get to the other side, and then you might get the packet early, but you don't start processing that packet until it's time for that packet to happen, and so there's sort of like this long queue of like 400 milliseconds before your actions need to take effect, and if it doesn't get there by then the game will it'll still allow you to like, click buttons and do things, but really the simulation has stalled out and the units stop moving. Until, like, you know, you start getting packets again from all the players.
So sort of the architecture of that original Warcraft networking model was something like, I have a queue of user input, basically, and they might just be doing a bunch of stuff, and it's getting stacked up, and it really, I start sending it out, and until I get confirmation back that the next sort of, like, step has occurred, I can't actually pull anything, you know, I can't actually consider one of these UI options executed, so I'm just kind of trying to buy time until that happens. Is that similar?
I just wait until I get packets from every single player in the game. And it, you know, scales naturally to 2 to 8 players in Warcraft 2 and Starcraft. And you, as soon as you've got everybody's packet, then you can execute the turn, although you generally wait until it's, like, you know, enough time has elapsed. We're doing like 4 network turns per second in Warcraft 1.
So basically what happens is all of the people send sort of a I guess what I'm hearing you say there, which is not sort of the way I was picturing it when you first said it. So there's basically like fixed slices of time, these 400 milliseconds, well, like you said, it was a tunable parameter. There's fixed slices of time, and basically everyone is going to get to make a move in that time, and that move may be I didn't make a move, correct, but everyone's going to get to send what their move was. And if I don't hear from anybody, we just keep running out the clock if we don't hear from everybody in that time, or?
That's right. For the next couple seconds, like, I'll still take input on the local client side. And then after, like, if I haven't heard from anybody from, I'm just going to guess, like, 5 seconds, then I actually gray out the screen so you can't do anything. Because clearly we now have an issue.
Something went wrong.
Okay. And so people get the idea that, oh, I'm not enabled to do anything.
So that's pretty interesting. That, I guess, in that sense, that's a pretty clean division of the networking code from everything else too. It's like it can almost exist in a vacuum, because as long as you're really the only thing, I guess, that you need from the game at that point is the ability to not, you know, the ability to just not execute something. But that should be pretty easy, because if the user's not doing anything, it doesn't execute something.
That's right.
Okay, so that's actually kind of cool. So
and I would say, like, it would be really nice. Yes, it could be so easily isolated and everything, but if you're to look at the code, you go like, where is it? It's everywhere. It's spread out.
Oh, really?
Whoops. Yeah, the first Warcraft was a mess.
Okay. So was that is that? But that would be something that is fixable, meaning the integration into it isn't necessary. It's just how it happened to organically occur.
That's right. Organic is a good word for that.
Okay.
But you know, that was my first like original development project, so I had to learn along the way.
Yeah. Okay, so moving forward, I guess, then, for, like, Warcraft 2, for example, same sort of thing?
Yeah, like, really not a whole lot had to change. You know, there are a lot of data structures that just assume 2 players, and so there'd just be, you know, Boolean values for them, and then it's like, well, we're going to do 8 players now. Well, we can pack 8 players into 1 byte, right?
Okay.
Just 1 bit flag for each entry. And so it was really more a failure of vision that Warcraft 1 didn't have more players in it. It's like,
okay,
we could do 2 players. Oh my gosh, that's a lot, right? You know, we could have done more, but we were thinking about modem play.
I see. And then by that time, it had kind of gotten a little bit better in terms of what it could support and how many people. I guess with Warcraft, you learn what people might want to do, which is play 8 player games or other things like this.
That's right.
Okay, so from there, the next title is sort of drastically different, I guess, is my understanding. So you then did the networking layer for Diablo, which is, you did the part where it's the actual in-game networking layer, right? I guess someone else was responsible for the Battle.net back-end sort of system?
That's right.
So Diablo is not synchronous in this way, is that correct?
Right. So Diablo was actually developed by another company that was acquired by Blizzard Entertainment. It was a bunch of guys at Condor. And they had this great idea, like Diablo was their idea. And when we heard about it, we're like, this is awesome, we need to be doing this game with them. But they were making a single-player, single-character game, and
okay,
we convinced them that they should do a multiplayer. Oh, and eventually when we convinced them to do a multiplayer, they're like, we want it to be turn-based multiplayer. We're like, no, it's got to be real-time.
Okay.
And so we, you know, when we convinced them to do that, it's like, okay, so go do that. And then, like, they really needed some help to get it done, and so I actually flew up there with a plan to go and figure out how to help them. And it was going to be a synchronous network model, like
similar to Warcraft.
Yeah, exactly, because I'd already done that, and it would prevent cheating. And you know, I looked at the code. It's like, you know, it's going to be really hard to back end a synchronous system into a game that's already been written and like doesn't really have like the data construct where it's thinking about like, let's keep the server stuff over here, you know, like the simulation stuff over here and the game stuff over here. It was all just intermixed. And okay, so then I just when you threw everything out the window and wrote a different network model.
So when you say that, you kind of mean that my representation for a particular object in the world in something like Warcraft is a little more split in terms of, like explain a little bit more what you mean by you looked at the code and found something you didn't expect in terms of that welding.
Sure. So if you're doing a network simulation, you want to ideally have all your network data structures separate because they're going to get modified only when packets show up that should be affecting that data. And your simulation data, your user interface data is probably going to be separate because, like, you know, I'm tweaking things, I have status bar updates for these units. There's lots of stuff that the network code and the client code are going to have that are different because of the time that changes, right? The simulation can only change when packets show up, and the client data can change instantaneously as I click the mouse and click the keyboard and things.
And so in something like Warcraft 2, where you'd already had some experience with it, you guys had sort of gotten to the point where you were already dividing the code base up into this way, I guess is sort of the thing. But when you went to their code base, that's, you know, it was all still kind of intermixed.
Yeah, also the other factor is when you're doing synchronous lockstep games, the problem is you cannot have any coding errors. Because if you if you've played one game already and you've initialized some of your internal state variables slightly differently than mine, I'm playing my first game, then you do a command and it doesn't behave exactly the same on your system as it does on my system, and the games desynchronize and we can just disconnect because we don't know what else to do.
So basically there's divergence there because of some state that was not cleanly initialized.
That's right. And so you have to be exceptionally careful, and it's just ridiculous how hard this is, right? Like, accidental pointer use of after the pointer's been freed, or uninitialized variables, or static variables that don't get reinitialized.
Right.
Like, lots of things can really impact this. And so it takes a long time to find these bugs too. And like Diablo was written in haste, and it just didn't have the same level of carefulness with respect to variables. And so there was just no way to do a synchronous lockstep game with that.
And so what was your approach then? So you decide to change things up. You're like, we're gonna have to do something different. What was that thought process like? Because you said you came up with their other plan, and now the plan is gone, right?
That's right. So I came up with a plan in like a day, and it's what I call like an asynchronous, loosely coupled game.
Okay.
So we're all playing sort of the same game, but not exactly.
Okay.
So you happen to be the first person to get onto like level one of the game, and so you're now the master for that level. And when I come to the game, to come down to that level of the game, so for people who haven't played Diablo, 16-level dungeon.
Okay.
There's a master for each level.
Okay.
So I get to your
level. And the master
level
is whoever happens to load up that level first.
Correct.
In some way. How do we know that? Because it's network, so I don't know who loaded first.
Well, like, you created the game.
Okay.
And then I join into your game.
Okay.
And so, like, you have the authority to you're the first person on, like, level zero, the town level.
Okay.
And then you go down to level one, and then when I join your game, you see that I go down to level two first, and so you're like, okay, you're the master for level two, and as long as I'm in the game, I'm the master. If I were to drop out, then there'd be no master, or arguably you could say, any of them could pick up the master position.
So let's just drill down on that for 1 second. So that sounds like sort of a consensus problem across these clients, though, because like when I say I see that you drop down to level two first, how do I know that I've seen that at the right time, or how does another client know? Like, is there some kind of centralized, like the person who owned level zero is the person who decides who owns level one, or how does that, like, because I mean, in networking, things can come in at any time, and you never really know who said what when. Right?
That's right. So the person who created the game is sort of the arbiter of who is the level master for each level.
Okay.
And then if that player drops out, then the next player who came into the game was, and like they just increasing sequence.
I see.
Numbers.
Okay, so basically, the person who started the game, they are the master, and they will be periodically sending out a list of who's in the game, and your order in that, where they are first and the next person second, third, is like the order we'll go through to keep trying to play this game if something bad happens, kind of a thing.
That's right.
Okay.
So you are the master for the game, I go to level two, and you tell me, okay, you're level master for two, and so I'm like, great, I get to initialize everything myself and tell people what's going on that level.
I see.
And then after that point, so now I've taken over ownership of level two, and I'm like, I'm picking up things and dropping them, and I'm telling all the other players, yeah, I picked up this item and dropped this item. So if I drop out of the game, and then we need a new level two master, then somebody else can pick it up, and they can sort of apply all the knowledge of what happened there previously, like there's dead monsters here, and this treasure chest has been broken open. Then they can reapply all those rules so that the world seems consistent.
I see, and so they kind of keep a buffer of, here's all the stuff I've been told about level two, even though I myself am not actually keeping a representation of level two yet.
That's right.
So at that time, if we do need to do like basically a failover or something like this, or if I come on to level two, I guess would be another case where I just am starting to look at level two, I'm going to go in and take this buffer that I've been recording of everything that I've been told about level two, and I'm going to replay it order to get my level two to that state.
That's right. And our lists may not match up exactly because of hacking or things like that. And so that's why I call it loosely coupled, because we're really playing two games that are nearly identical. But it's obviously very, very cheatable.
And so what happens now as the game is being played? Two of us are both on the same level and we're doing stuff. What is that networking process like? One person is the master for the level, and then we have n number of other people who are sort of getting information about it. But what does that actually look like?
We're all broadcasting messages to all the other players saying, this is what happened. I pick up, a sword and I start, I tell all the other players that sword is now gone. And so you can have a race condition for that.
Yeah.
And we just sort of arbitrate it, the level master gets to make the determination of who actually got that.
So basically two people, in their separate copies of this game, they both go to pick up the sword, right? And they both think that they've picked up the sword, so they send out the packet, I picked up the sword.
Well, more like I am attempting to pick up the sword.
Okay, so there's actually a two-stage process. I'm attempting to pick up the sword, two packets come in, that we can't really tell who maybe was doing it first or whatever, so the level master goes, I see two people are trying to pick up the sword, and I decided to break this tie however I decided to break it.
That's
any
right.
Particular nuance to that, or it's like, doesn't really matter?
No, it's pretty straightforward. It's whoever got it first, and of course, if you're the level master, you're always going to be faster, because it's a local loopback.
Okay, and so is that roughly the way that most things in the game work? So if I try to attack somebody, is it a similar two-stage process? I'm trying to attack this person, and then the level master acknowledges it, and only once he acknowledges it do I actually see the attack occur? Or is it more asynchronous than that, in that I see the attack occur either way, but maybe the damage goes back up later if it turns out it didn't acknowledge? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, in terms of like, how does that work out when we're actually doing other sorts of things besides something as discrete as picking up the sword?
Right, so it's really loose. So like, you go and attack a monster on your system and you kill him and you decide that he's dead, and then you let me know that he's dead.
Okay.
And I'm the level master and I go, okay, great.
Okay.
Yeah. So, it's really possible to cheat very easily, right? You can just kill anything as fast as you want.
And that isn't really, but ignoring the cheating part of it, in terms of actually keeping the stuff working in the actual game, it's not really necessary to do anything beyond that. Meaning, if a bunch of people who are all trying to play the game, legitimately not hacking it, not trying to do anything weird, then simply having the clients announce when they did something, and if two people say that they killed the monster, it doesn't matter, because like the state just goes to dead, and so it's fine, that
kind
of
thing?
That's
right. Right. The only area of contention is in picking up things off the ground.
Okay.
Or breaking open a chest. Even that doesn't, because the chest is broken open. Both players might have done it at the same time, but it leads to like things popping out on the ground that you can then pick up that are the areas that you fight over.
So the only, is that because things like damage are just numbers that go down? So if I get two people who say they did damage, I just apply them both? Or is that just because picking up is the one thing where it's like there was only one item and we need to know
correct.
Who had it, kind of a thing?
Exactly.
Okay. All right, so I think that's pretty good fundamentals. I'm trying to think if I missed anything of the sort of...
You missed one thing. Don't do a game like this.
Okay, why not?
Because people will cheat.
Okay.
And in fact, the thing that happened was, Diablo came out and people really loved the game, and a lot of players had fun, particularly when they played with their own friends. But as soon as you played out there in the larger universe, there were just lots of people who were griefing. And in fact, it was really startling to me because, I'd played MUDs before and things like that, and occasionally there was griefing, but usually you had like GMs that would oversee things, like volunteer GMs.
It
would sort of like make sure that people weren't complete assholes.
Right, right.
A couple days after we shipped Diablo, there was a friend of the company who came in, and he was playing in an office adjacent to me, a guy named Yash, and he's just like going into dungeons and he's killing people because he's much higher level than them, and there's nothing that they could do about it. And all their armor and swords and everything pop off onto the ground, and then they get reincarnated in town, and they come down to the dungeon naked and try and recover their stuff, and he kills them again. And again and again.
This was
again.
At your own company.
And he taunts them. Well, he was actually just a friend of somebody who worked at the company.
Okay, just a friend, okay.
And I was like, I watched him, and I realized that this was a microcosm of stuff that was gonna happen.
Right.
So I didn't say
you saw the future.
I didn't say you shouldn't do this or anything like that. Instead I was like, let me understand this. And that's really my first serious experience with griefers. And it was shocking at that time. And now, every game I've ever designed since, I have to think about how are people going to hack this, and how are people going to, especially abuse others, which is in some ways even worse than hacking.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay. So that's actually kind of fascinating. So moving forward, I guess the next one you did was Guild Wars, yes?
StarCraft and then Guild Wars.
But, okay, so you did the network on StarCraft as well.
Yeah, it was a lot of the same stuff.
Was that asynchronous or was that synchronous? Was that more like the Warcraft model?
Just like Warcraft 2.
Okay, yeah. Just like Warcraft 2. Okay, so after Starcraft, you go to start Guild Wars. And I remember Guild Wars was particularly impressive to me because like I remember like the download to download Guild Wars was like this little tiny thing, right? Yeah. Like, it was some kind of like little tiny executable and it just like took care of everything from there and all this sorts of stuff.
That's right, it was a 200K executable 200K. Roughly. And so the challenge was that it was so small that people would click on it to download and it would go so fast, they'd be like, did that work? So I think we should have made it bigger.
We gotta pad it out just to make sure they can see the progress bar.
That's right.
So Guild Wars is, in some ways, a lot more ambitious than Diablo because this now is sort of designed up front to have a lot of the permanence maybe backed up by more authenticated sorts of things, I guess. This comes out of your experience with the griefing on Diablo, I guess. Is that, would that
That's
be
right.
fair?
And okay. also the desire to have an online economy.
Okay, okay. So this one, I guess, well, I got kind of a list of things to drill down in here, but before I maybe ask any of those questions, can you give maybe people a brief understanding of what was involved in making Guild Wars happen? Because it's got both a persistent state and it's got a peer-to-peer thing happening and those things interact and there's just, I remember you sent me an email where you're like, here's all the servers we wrote for Guild Wars and there was like 12 or something on this list. So can you just give a brief, just high level explanation of what was involved in just the basic architecture of this system?
Sure. So first, it was not a peer-to-peer game at all. It was a client-server only. So
So even when people were playing inside their own, when they would kind of spawn off the dungeon, that was still always round-tripped through a separate server.
That's right.
Okay, sorry.
Fully server-hosted. So the very first thing you do is you connect up to the server and say, hi, I'm Guild Wars version 0, because you've got this 200K stub. And it's like, oh, you need version 53. Here you go. Download, you reboot. The game engine, oh, hey, I'm version 53, what should I get? Okay, great, you're up to date. Here's the manifests for every single piece of data in the whole world.
Okay.
You know, and you download that file, and then you say, well, I want to go to the login screen, give me all the files I need for that. And you download those, and you know, progressively you start accumulating all the files you need, so that you never actually have to download the entire, roughly at that point, 3 gigabytes of data. You could just download the tiny portion that you need.
So this was actually sort of like an on-demand package manager you basically had in here, which is like,
right.
We have a dependency system, we know everything in the world and what it depends on, so when the game starts up, it just kind of asks for some kind of like a root object for what it's trying to do, like I'm trying to go into this dungeon, so I need, you know, I ask for that, and then it starts pulling in things, and you're like, okay, now I'm going to ask for this, and that pulls in more things. These get downloaded into sort of a cache on the drive that
you
keep? Okay. And those are marked in some way to tell whether they're stale in case they're updated, or does that never happen?
Yes, every file effectively is an ID number that is both the identity for it and the version number.
Okay.
And so you can know whether you're up to date on the file. And so if it turns out that you're out of date, you could say, I have version 17 of the warrior armor, and it goes, oh, and if you look in the manifest, it's like, oh, I need version 19. So you say to the file server, you know, want 19, have 17, and it loads up both those files, delta compresses them.
Seriously?
Actually, deltas them, then it compresses them and sends you down that small chunk, because this was 2005 when we were doing this. Actually, 2002 when we were writing the code for it. And, you know, like, bandwidth was much lower than it is today, so we had to make everything as small as possible, otherwise it would have been hours and hours and hours before you could get into the game.
That's awesome. Okay, so you on-demand delta compress the difference between the version they have and the version they need, and send only the delta down.
Correct.
That's like better than most internet infrastructure probably is everywhere in the world right now, but okay. Going back to sort of that sort of process of getting things,
right.
You said the ID number and you said it's both the ID and the version. You mean they're together, or the ID is somehow intermixed with the version? It's just two separate pieces of data, ID and version?
That's right. So every file has a base ID, which is the very first file number that was assigned to it when the asset was created.
Okay.
So, you know, I create a texture. It's like, well, you just happen to be number 3, right? And so and I can, forevermore, I can refer to that texture as 3, but now it has different version numbers. So like, you know, it's also, you know, file 17 and file 28. You know, every time the artist changes it, that texture gets a number with it. And so I always refer to it by the base ID, and I look in the manifest for it, and it's like, for the base ID 3, the current version is 781.
I see.
And I say, I need 781, and I have 3 or 17 or whatever the previous version I had.
And so, sorry, this is just kind of fascinating, so sorry, this is not technically networking.
That was a couple years of my life, so I'm
Yeah, okay. And just one other question about that, I guess, because we sort of talked about this with when we were talking about Super Meat Boy as well, and what Tommy was doing, and it's just kind of fresh in my head. Like, how do you assign these IDs to things that artists make? Because by definition, an artist is not somebody who goes and knows what a Mace ID necessarily is. So how does that process work? I'm somebody who needs to add a texture to Guild Wars. Is there a server that you query? Are there tool? Give me a quick idea of what that looks like.
So we're using Perforce as our revision control system.
Okay.
So they check the file into Perforce, and then there'd be some way that file was referenced. So perhaps there was a model file.
Okay.
And the model file, using 3ds Max, refers to this texture file by name.
Okay.
And so, and then that model file is referenced in a level file.
Okay.
Say it's a tree, since that seems to be the model for today. And then the level file contains a bunch of different assets in it. And then the level file is actually referenced in some source code. This is level 13 of the game, or this is like the Lion's Arch outpost.
Okay.
And so, what happens is there's a tool, FS build, that goes through and it picks up all the code references to assets. And it's like, okay, let me load this level file. And then let me look at the dependencies this has. Oh, it's got a model file in it. Let me load the model file. Let me look at all the dependencies. Oh, it's got a texture file. Let me load that. Oh, textures don't have any dependencies. Okay, so now I can process that file. That file is now file ID 3 because it's the third file that was ever processed.
Okay, and that whole stack gets processed up into the piece of data that's actually referenced?
That's right.
So the textures aren't referenced separately, or they are?
They can be referenced separately, that's right. So it processes and saves file ID 3 in this big, giant, data, well, you can think of it as a database of files that has, more or less every version of a file back, say, 90 days or something like that.
And so when you're doing that, how can you tell that I'm an artist, I made a new version of this texture, does it correlate those? Does it just use the path, the full file path in Perforce as the thing that it knows it's seen this before? So that thing kind of tracks those and can associate the IDs internally with that Perforce path, or?
That's right. So FSBuild loads up all the assets and creates this graph of everything. And then it goes, oh, well, that file hasn't changed. I don't have to do anything for it, right? So because it has lots of metadata associated with the build process. So it knows when files were last touched. And if something breaks, it knows which artist checked that file in.
Okay.
Although maybe that's not the reason why it broke, right? Because it'd be the programmer changed some code, which caused all the art files to break.
Okay, all right. Sorry, that was a bit of a rat hole. I just was kind of curious. I wanted to know kind of about that system because it's pretty interesting. Okay, so going back to the networking part of things. So essentially, you've got this system where it sounds like there's already kind of one server that we've already sort of talked about what it is, which is we need something that's sitting there running that has every version of every asset that we've ever shipped on it, which can answer this question, right? And presumably, we need more than one of these because everyone's getting the data from this. So talk a little bit about how that works.
Sure. So we have lots of these file servers all over the world. So Guild Wars is kind of unique in its era for being a game that had no monthly fee. And so we couldn't have lots of servers to do all this stuff. We needed to be extremely efficient in the way that we did everything. So we wrote everything from scratch because there weren't tools that would do this delta compression stuff. Mm. But so we have lots of file servers out there, and they're spread out all over the world. And it's kind of interesting why. If you connect to a really long-distance TCP server, what happens is there's this thing called the TCP window. And so I send you a few messages, and you send me back a bunch of stuff. But as a server, you're I'm not going to send you more than 64K of data because I don't want to flood out the internet.
Okay.
And until that 64K of data gets acknowledged, I'm not going to send you more stuff. So you can only have at most 64K of data outstanding.
And when you say server, who do you mean? Because you're in control of the server.
In this case, the file server.
Okay, so it only sends 64K of data. You've set that up. You picked that.
So the TCP stack the window size is 64K.
Okay.
And so until we negotiate a bigger window size, that's as much as it'll send. And in Windows of that era, you had really limited ability to control TCP parameters.
So you couldn't even set it.
Especially on the game client, right? Because, you can't go and hack people's registry.
I see. Yeah, nowadays, I guess you can possibly set those options dynamically in code, but then you couldn't.
Yeah, but even then, Windows XP, you'd have to reboot.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so keep going. So you're about to say there's problems with this.
Right, so what you want to do is instead of trying to get stuff from a really long distance away server where 64K, you send it, and then there's a long pause before the acknowledgement comes back, and so you're not constantly filling the stream. So you want to have the file server really close to people so that you can send a lot of data more quickly. So instead of the delay being the limiting factor, instead it's the size of the channel being the limiting factor of how much bandwidth you can send.
Is that workaroundable, meaning let's say I actually only had one file server, It sounds like that's per TCP connection. So in theory, could a client be written to open multiple TCP connections to the server so that it can start multiple 64K chunks in parallel? But you decided not to do that, I guess.
That's right. You certainly could do that. But what we did is we just distributed servers all over the world. Like, we had them in Japan, Taiwan, Korea, two data centers in the US, and a data center in Europe. And that was enough to do the job to cover most of our user base. I mean, Australian users had to suffer, but we just couldn't afford to put servers there, too.
Fair enough.
Yeah, and so we just had lots of those servers, which creates another interesting problem, which is whenever you want to do a build, you have to make sure that every server has all the data before you can really say that the build is truly live. So it's a distributed database commit problem.
How did you handle that?
It's actually fairly straightforward. It's like, okay, everybody got the data? Everybody? Everybody ready? Ready? Go! And then afterwards, you're like, okay, did everybody get it? Okay, we're good, right? And then if one of them didn't get it, then you keep trying again and again.
You're just like, get it, get it, get it. And then eventually he wakes up.
Yeah, but you wait until everybody's got all the data, and then you try and commit the metadata on all the systems simultaneously. And there's only like twice in 5 years that it ever failed.
And wow, okay. And that's, so.
Like, failed in a way that required human intervention.
These are database, when you say database, are you talking literally about something that you guys wrote, or are you talking about?
That's right.
So basically, it's not like we installed MySQL or something. It's like we wrote this thing from scratch to do exactly this job of serving the art assets.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah, and in fact, like, it's embedded in the Guild Wars client. When you see the gw.dat file, it's sort of the database file format that we use for everything.
And what kind of load were these servers under? So, like, what were they designed to serve, basically? How many people updating and how much traffic? I mean, do you have any kind of, just to give people a ballpark, there weren't that many of them. You said six or seven, something it sounded like?
There were six data centers.
Six data centers.
But, like, within each data center, there were lots of these file servers.
Okay, so you would just duplicate the file server as many times you needed to for the load in that area?
That's right.
How much would one typically handle, do you think, or is that?
So each one would saturate, like, its uplink at about 400 megabit.
Okay.
And they just run, like, 400 megabit sustained load during peak time.
So the majority of your actual, the thing that actually prevented you from serving more stuff on a particular server was actually just the outflow pipe.
It was actually a combination of factors. So it's file servers are actually really fascinating, and it's like really easy to do things wrong. But there are three things. There's like how much the network card could push onto the network. We were using blade servers, and so blade servers, unlike individual pizza box servers, blade servers have a shared network, or in that era, they had like a shared network like infrastructure for the entire row of 14 blade servers.
Okay.
So you could saturate, that would be a problem. So you had to spread your file servers out so they couldn't all be in the same rack. They had to be in different racks.
Oh my God.
The other thing is that the amount of data that we're sending is very large. And so these servers all had only 2.5 gigs of memory. And you've got to subtract out some for the operating system and stuff like that. So you could have about 1.5 gigs of cache, but you've got to have enough space left over for like load file A, load file B, delta compress them. Now you've got file A, file B, and the delta in memory all at the same time. And then you want to keep that in memory as long as you can, because presumably other users want that. But if you keep it in memory too long, then you run out of memory and crash, and so that's no good.
I see.
So it's this constant thing of like trying not to run out of cache space and trying to avoid virtual memory fragmentation, because these servers are supposed to run for years at a time. And so like memory fragmentation is a big issue. So we had to use a Fibonacci heap.
Are you serious?
Like various different sizes of heap buffers in order to make sure that there's always like a nice slot available for the file that you want to load up.
That's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
So
a lot of engineering just went into that one server by itself.
Yeah,
and the build process, to make the build process really fast. Because like, if there's any one thing you can do in your games, you want to make your iteration speed as fast as you possibly can, because that's going to determine the quality of your game. If you can only get one build done per day, then when people try and put something in the game and they have to wait to get user feedback, like, they just don't get that feedback right away. We did, so over the course of Guild Wars, we did an average of 20 builds a day for 4 years. It was roughly 10 a day in the beginning and like closer to 30 to 40 a day at the end of the project. So we were just churning builds like roughly every 5 minutes during the ordinary course of business, and then data builds took a bit longer. And so we spent a lot of engineering effort. When I say we, I mean me, myself, and I. But I mean, there were other people who worked on like texture compressors and like, like loaders and things like that. But FS build was my baby, and like, I had to make it fast because that was the core of the build time for things. And so every time I can make that faster, I can make it more efficient for like the entire rest of the 60 person dev team to get their stuff in and see it.
And so that was kind of a live process because they wanted to be able to, was that, I'm just not sure I totally understand, because obviously iteration, you can iterate internal to the company, but this sounds like something that you're iterating external to the company.
Well, it's really both. Like you want all the people on your team to be able to see stuff instantaneously, but we started an alpha program in roughly April 2001 where we invited a few friends and family, and that grew within a relatively short period of time to 500 to 2,000 people that we kept through the entire alpha process. And when we, when some people would leave or get tired or our numbers were not high enough because of exhaustion of the game, then we'd just bring in more people.
Okay.
And so like our dev build was actually going out to 2,000 people every single time that we did it.
So basically FS Build was both the server for your internal, essentially your internal testing and the actual game.
That's
no
right.
difference, really.
We made no difference between devs and alphas.
Okay, so let me just ask one other question that I had about the server, although I suppose there are a lot of questions I could ask, but I want to make sure we get sort of coverage of different areas. So when you said like keeping the cache, you were like, I got to load these two files up, I'll do the delta, and then I'll try to keep the two files and the delta in, I presumably flush the two files. I just keep the delta with a tag on it or something that says, this was the delta between these two files, so if someone wants that delta, it'll hit the cache and I'll send it out. The idea is presumably that we want that second level of caching because probably most people are up to date. So probably when somebody wanted this delta, someone right after them is going to call for the same delta kind of thing. Okay. All right, so let's move from file serving down to sort of the next level. So this is, now my client can actually get all of the data that I need to play Guild Wars, and it's self-updating, and it sounds pretty awesome in terms of like keeping everyone on the same sort of set of data. Now I need to start talking about how to actually play the game, like how that server infrastructure works. So there's a bunch of things involved there. Why don't you give a little overview of how that works, and then we can kind of drill down into that.
So the next server you talk to is the lobby server, and that's the one that handles authentication and presence. So again, for people who don't have familiarity with the Guild Wars, it's not like in a traditional MMO where you join one map and you stay there for a really long period of time. Instead, you join a particular game and you play there for a brief while, and then you join another game. So I might go to an outpost where there's like 100, 150 people running around, and then, hey, let's go play in an instance map, and then you and I get our own private copy of a two-player or four-player, eight-player world, and we play there for a while, and we finish that, and we go play a tournament game, which is, five teams of eight people, and then we play an arena map, which is two teams of eight people. So we're playing lots of different maps, and so because you don't have a persistent connection, we don't have a way to send you messages all the time. So what we do is instead you connect to the lobby server first, and your lobby server connection is persistent, and so when you get whispers from your friends or when we need to send you any notifications, that can all go through that persistent connection through the lobby. So the lobby, you authenticate yourself, you get your friends list, you get like your guild information, because this is called Guild Wars, right? and all the other information you need to maintain a persistent state. And also, we establish like some encryption keys because all the data is encrypted back and forth.
And is that process, so I guess this is something that probably should be brought up now just so it can be mentioned in different parts of it. So like TCP versus UDP was the big thing you put in the email. It's actually the first thing you said. So do you want to mention briefly like sort of what these different systems are that we're talking about? Were they TCP, were they UDP, and why? It sounds like the file server was TCP because you mentioned the window, the send window. What is the lobby server, TCP as well?
So for Guild Wars, everything is TCP.
Okay, so everything in the game is TCP, no UDP.
That's right.
All right, and so...
And incidentally, the reason for that was, like, we were going to use TCP, and then we were going to decide later on if we needed to use UDP for the server-to-client protocol.
Okay.
We thought we would need to, but it turned out it just wasn't a big issue for the type of game that we were doing.
Okay.
But, like, it was expedient for us to write a TCP-based game.
Okay. And so... Keep going with that. So I got to connect to the lobby server. So I TCP to the lobby server, and I get my information back from that. And presumably this is also going to involve, you said you don't ever do peer-to-peer. So presumably I'm going to have to route the packets for the rest of the game to the people I'm playing with through somebody. Is that also the lobby server?
That's right.
So how does that process sort of start?
So sure. So the lobby server talks to the database server. And pulls down all your data, and then after that it talks to the server, which is it's called SiteServe, but it's like a matchmaking server, and it says player Pat was last in Lion's Arch, and so find a Lion's Arch server, and so the matchmaking server doesn't have any of those yet, right? Because it's a brand new build, or like everything crashed a minute ago, and we're bringing up the whole thing, or it's like day one of the game, whatever. And so it has a whole bunch of game servers that have connected up to the matchmaking server and said, hi, I'm available to host games. I have X capacity. And so the matchmaking server says, you are going to host the game. Go create a Lion's Arch. We'll call it District 1.
Okay.
And then the server would create that, send back a token to the match server. The match server sends it back to the lobby server to the client. The client's got this token, which is like a token that says, I'm allowed to join this game and the address of that game.
Okay.
So then I join that game and I say, hi, I'm Pat, here's my token. Let's encrypt this communication. Then the game server then goes to the database cache server, says, get me the Pat's record. Oh, he's not loaded yet. Database cache server goes to the database server, get me the record. Here's your entire record, which has all your inventory, like the parts of the map that you've explored, how much gold you have, you know, everything interesting about your character.
So there's a ton of servers in there that you've just mentioned.
That's just
for
all
that.
Just the basics, right?
Just for the basics. So, okay, so the first question is, I guess before I ask any more specifics about those, why are there so many servers? So why was this a load balancing thing? Was this just a cleanliness thing or a testability thing? Like, why do we have that many servers involved in just this one process?
Sure. So it's really good when you have a lot of complexity to try and simplify your program, because if you're trying to do too many things at once, then if one of them crashes, it takes down everything else.
Okay.
So like isolation of components, also, you know, just from an understanding something standpoint, if you can't understand something, it's really hard to modify. So the smaller something is, the better it fits into the like 7 ± 2 items in your brain, right? And each one of those, you know, like things can be separated, right? Separation of concerns is the CS terminology for that.
So basically your approach to this basically would be, if we can define a set of operations that clearly form something that can all be done with the same set of data, we're going to make that into a separate server if we can. Even if that's going to run on the same machine as some other server, we'd rather have it be like its own sort of self-contained thing.
That's right.
Rather than merging these two things together.
That's right. And then also, you know, another really compelling reason to do that is like you can keep buying bigger and bigger services, but the cost for the server goes up. Instead of being a linear cost, it scales exponentially. So, you know, if you want a 4-processor server, it's more than twice as expensive as a 2-processor server. And 8-processor is more than 4 times as expensive as a 2-processor server.
So if you can have the ability to distribute these things across lots of cheaper machines, it's a win there as well.
That's right. And then also, like when you design your stuff to be, it's called horizontally scalable. You know, like vertically scalable is buy a bigger server, right? But you can only get so big before you run out of, like there isn't a 256 core server that you can just go out and buy, or at least you couldn't in 2004 era.
Probably not even close, but yeah.
Yeah, without spending like multi-millions of dollars probably.
Yeah.
So you want to scale horizontally, and that causes you to re-architect the way that you write your software. And also then, you know, like, oh, well, one of our auth servers blew up.
Right.
Big deal.
Okay. Because you just have lots of auth servers running
wherever,
and it's totally fine. Okay, so going back to sort of that server breakdown then. So if my philosophy is like lots of little servers, each that does a specific job, I can distribute them anywhere I want, and I like programming it that way because then I have a much more well-defined sort of, you know, problem space and solution to the problem. What about sort of the extra interconnect that this generates? Meaning the fact that now these things have to talk to each other, don't I sort of introduce a new failure point or a new thing I've got to get right every time these two servers can't just call a function, they've got to actually now have a packet protocol. How did you approach that? Because that seems like that would then be something you maybe want to systematize or something.
I mean, that's right.
Tell me how you thought about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So the servers speak a different protocol, and it's like, you know, an RPC protocol. It happened to be a custom one, although like there's lots of different versions of that. So today, like today, you'd use protobufs or Thrift or message pack or something like that.
Okay.
Because like lots of people have studied this problem and figured out like the right thing to do. Or, you know, another new one is Captain Proto.
And you think these are good, meaning like you've looked at them and go like, these would be, these we could have used these and they would have been okay.
If they existed in that time
frame, if they existed,
Absolutely. So, you know, you just need some standardized RPC protocol that in particular has the capability to do versioning, because, you know, day one you do something and then like 3 weeks later you're like, oh, we should have added this parameter, we have a new feature. So you need to think about how you would add additional features without having to like take down all of your servers and do a maintenance period. One of the other rather unique things about Guild Wars was that we tried never to do maintenance.
Okay.
Like we ran 24/7, 365,
okay.
No maintenance periods, which is extremely unusual.
Yeah, that does sound weird.
And so like what you had to do was like rolling upgrades of your servers. Like you'd upgrade one, it had to continue to work, like new version and old version, old, you know, rather new protocol and old protocol had to continue to work, but now that you've got a new server running, it can speak the new protocol and new, you know, it can do additional functionality. So you take down the servers, you're like, okay, this server's gonna go out of service, everybody get off it, okay, it's empty, kill, restart with new version. Okay, server number two, you know, get all the users off.
And is that some kind of a, so that sort of scale down, meaning I've got to flush everything off. This is a thing that had to be built into all the servers, I assume, was the concept that like you have to go down for maintenance now, and we built that in from day one, the concept that you can go down for maintenance, you get everyone off, and they go to some other servers, and then we can do whatever kinds of upgrades we're going to do to you.
That's right.
And this was built into every server, or do you kind of like, so when you talk about having so many servers, and I can't remember the number, but you had listed so many servers there on that line when you sent me the email. There was over 10, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think there's 18.
18 servers. Did you develop that with a particular, I don't want to say framework because you know that's kind of maybe a loaded term, but did you essentially have some code that is shared between all these servers, which is like, okay, we kind of get this now, maybe a little bit into it, how we want these servers to work, so we kind of built a standard, our standard server library.
Like, absolutely.
What does that look like?
Another interesting thing is that like the core of all the servers was one set of code that could do like file handling, memory management, and socket, and hot reloading of like modules.
Okay.
So a module would be like the file server module, or the matchmaking server, or the lobby server module could actually be dropped and reloaded dynamically.
So in a sense, a server instance may be thought of as the lobby server, but really it's sort of the generic server, like, top thing, whatever this is, with only the lobby server loaded up and running.
That's
but
right.
Technically, if we'd wanted to, we could have also had it load up a matchmaking server.
That's right. So, okay. The way to look at it is ArenaServe, which is the loader module, is an executable, and everything else is a DLL. And so, like on a developer system, you would actually load up every single DLL. So you could have the entire stack of 18 servers running.
I see.
In one
and test
process.
Them just right there and see how
that's
they.
That's right.
That's pretty fascinating. Okay. So I guess.
So we had to create a protocol to talk to everything, right? And so that protocol library then became part of, it could have been part of the core, but because we wanted the capability to update it really frequently, every single server used the same code, but it had it loaded in the DLL, so like it could be updated.
Okay,
and that's called like serve socket.
So basically, when you load a DLL, it also includes linked into it its version of whatever the protocol was, because it may be different than the one that, you know, some other thing that might be loaded on it or whatever. Or when we want to have it to, even if we're only loading one, when we want it to go away and come back, we don't want to then have to go like, oh, right, he's going away and he's changing his version, so now I have to like switch out the version of my protocol that I'm using. And things. So it's like, no, it's all just welded into that one DLL. It knows which protocol it was using. But that did come from a shared library that we use internally so that everyone just links to that and knows they can use it.
Correct.
Okay, wow.
He knows his stuff.
All right. So we don't have nearly as much time left as I would like, of course, but I guess I just want to quickly kind of go through some of these things here and get a little bit of your perspective on them. So talk a little bit about the TCP versus UDP thing, because you'd mentioned that, like I said, on the top of the thing, but you said Guild Wars used all TCP, which is kind of surprising to me. I actually had this discussion with some friends recently where I was like lamenting the fact that like you can't actually download a file in a browser. Like downloading a file in a browser is like an unsolved problem. Half the time it just like stops and nobody knows why, right? Mm-hmm. And so Guild Wars I don't think ever had any of these sorts of problems. So, you know, I guess does that sort of say that like, well, you know, can you give me a little bit of background, TCP versus UDP, and how do you, if you're going to do TCP, how did you do it right versus doing it wrong? Because I see so many things where it's obviously done wrong. Does that make sense as a question?
Sure.
Yeah.
So the first thing is TCP versus UDP. So TCP is a reliable ordered protocol, which means like even if you receive data out of order, then you'll wait for the piece that was supposed to come before it and insert that so that everything shows up in a nice stream. It's like reading a file, except that, you know, sometimes the file like handle gets broken and you can't read any more from it. Whereas UDP, you can send lots of packets. They arrive in any order that is unguaranteed, and some of them don't ever arrive at all.
Yeah.
And so, obviously TCP and UDP are built on the same underlying primitives, and TCP just has a lot of mechanisms to ensure that the reliable ordered guarantee actually happens. And you know, that may be not what you want for your game, because if you're doing a first-person shooter, you're sending position and angle, position and velocity, something like that, so that at any moment in time when I receive a packet, I know exactly where you are and where you're headed. But if I lose one of those, I don't care because I'll get the next one, which is your new position. And in fact, it would be bad to receive an old stale packet because now you're going to pop backwards in time. So TCP would be a terrible protocol for that. But for an MMO, it actually works really well because almost every single message that you would send is something that you would have wanted to know correctly, right? Like, I picked up this, right? That is not a message that you can lose, because if you did, then like multiple people could pick up the same item. And so reliable ordered protocol works really well. The downside to reliable ordered is like on some devices, like in mobile devices, for example, you lose those connections all the time, right? You're on the bus, you go through a tunnel, and TCP doesn't survive that trip through the tunnel. Whereas UDP, you know, the phone can keep going, no, really, try again, I'm here. And so UDP works great for mobile devices if you need like a high bandwidth connection. If you're gonna do something low bandwidth, like you would just use a simple RESTful interface like HTTP.
But what happens, so TCP connections are not necessarily reliable either, so presumably the game kind of has to deal with that state as well. And is that, like I said, kind of using the straw man of the browser that can't seem to download a file for some reason, is that just basically about, okay, the game just has to be smart about checking the connections, know, if I haven't received anything in a certain amount of time, kill it, start another one. Like, how much logic would you say you have to put into making a TCP connection work the way it needs to for a game versus the way it needs to apparently for a file browser or a web browser?
Yeah, I mean, if you were to look at the socket library for all of our servers and the client, it's all like the same kind of stuff. There's probably 1,000 lines for Windows 95 and 1,000 lines for NT.
Okay.
So it's not a huge amount of code. I think it's more the conceptual model that you have when working with sockets is that you just have to assume that it could break at any moment in time and plan for breaking. So we had sort of a coding standard in ReNAnet, which was like, don't have functions return failure. So don't return Boolean values like, I failed, something went wrong, except for a couple of cases. One of them is sockets and the other one is files.
Okay.
Like if you open a file, like obviously it can fail.
Yes.
But like for memory allocation, it either succeeds or your program blows up.
Okay.
You can set a flag saying, you know, I'd like to know if this would fail, and then you can, like, it'll
like actually a probe,
return,
basically.
Yeah, it'll return null and say, well, I'm sorry, I couldn't allocate that memory. Okay. And, but that code is obviously prepared to deal with that failure case. But the idea is, like, if you try and load a model file and it doesn't load up, what the heck are you going to do?
Okay.
Well, you know, you can crash the game, but that's not very user-friendly. So we just show a white box, like a 6-foot square box.
So you basically always had a case where it's like, when we do something that we know can fail, the code is designed around the fact that that's actually just a legal operating condition. Like, I'll either get this model or I won't. It's not an imperative, basically.
Right. Well, so for the model file, I'll always get a model file. I can ask if it's valid after
I load
it.
Oh, okay. I see.
But for a socket, you just have to look at it and go, like, at any moment, this thing can fail. And so what's my, you know, failure resolution for that? And of course, a lot of testing doesn't hurt either.
Yeah. Okay. And so so you never really had any misgivings about using TCP then? You felt like that was totally fine as long as you architect around the fact that you expect it to maybe go down, go back up, that sort of thing?
Yes. Although, like, in practice, the thing that really affected us the most was, you know, at any moment in time, like, somebody is doing maintenance on their gear somewhere.
Okay.
And so, like, you know, your packets are taking one path, like they're hopping through 18 different routers to get from your house to the servers. And, you know, gamers play at night, maintenance periods are at night, and so, like, the routes change, and or like the, you know, the company that's publishing our game decides that they're going to do maintenance in their data center and switch their devices. And you would think, like, I mean, you know, this is in 2005, right? Like, Cisco had been making routers since the 1980s, that they would have had solved this problem.
All right.
But there's this thing, it's called, you know, route convergence. And, like, what happens is your router takes, like, 30 seconds before, like, you have an active passive set of routers, right? And this the active gets taken down either by, you know, a manual control or, like, it just fails. And the other one's supposed to pick up. And it takes such a long time that your TCP connections all get torn down.
Okay.
And, you know, so you talk to the folks in the data center and they'd say, oh yeah, routes are converging. What the fuck does that mean? Right, what it means is that, like, you know, 70,000 players just lost their connection. Like, half of our users just lost their connection.
It does sound like something that in a sci-fi film could be about a bunch of people losing, like, the great convergence is happening, it's upon us.
Yeah.
Some routes are getting,
Right, whereas if you use UDP, then, you know, you have much more control over that process because, you know, you can just keep trying and eventually routes will converge. And, you know, your packets will start getting through again.
And so why didn't you guys decide to do something like, for example, use your own, you know, reliable stuff on top of UDP or something like that? It just never became that much of an issue?
Sure, yeah. The game worked well enough. Okay. And, like, we had plenty of technical challenges to solve
that weren't
after launch.
Okay.
You know, because that problem didn't really crop up until after launch.
Okay.
When you know, we started seeing maintenance periods from our publisher.
Like, I see.
Really, can you guys not do that?
That right?
Just don't change stuff. Right? Because changing things breaks them.
So, and one more question on that, because you were talking about, like, first-person shooter versus non or whatever. Guild Wars still is kind of an action-y game in the sense that I do see people, like, walking around and doing these sorts of things. Why do I not want that sort of UDP-likeness for that portion of it where I'm just sort of sending where guys are and I don't really want to know where they were, you know, 30 seconds ago. If that packet got dropped, I don't care anymore. What, like, was that just not that important, or was there reasons why for Guild Wars that's not true in the same way?
Right. Well, so we could have designed the game differently so it was more first-person shooter action-y, but we wanted to make a game that was less Twitch-focused.
Okay.
And so, like, all these things feed into each other, right? We had lots of different business rationales and gameplay rationales and technical rationales that we merged together to form our game. And like they all sort of overlap with each other. So like, yeah, we could have done arrow combat where you fire an arrow and you have to be aiming in the right direction, but we decided that was not what the spirit of the game that we were trying to build was. So when you fire an arrow, like, you know, you're actually over there because you've been running this way, and so I don't know that yet because of network latency. So I fire the arrow and the arrow, like, it doesn't really do, you know, it doesn't really curve in space, but like conceptually that's what it's doing, even if you can't see it, right? Because on my system, you're standing over there, I fire, it hits you. But really, you're standing over there, so, you know, you see me in a different place.
The doing a different still, thing.
And on your system, it looks one way, on my system, it looks another. The same resolution happens, right? At the point the arrow is fired, we decide whether it's going to hit or not. It has nothing to do with motion.
And I suppose that's a good, let's see, like I said, we're super low on time, unfortunately, but so I suppose that's a good thing to tie it back to the earlier games as well. So we haven't talked much about how the architecture works for the actual gameplay inside Guild Wars. So it sounds like this is maybe sort of a hybrid of the two in some sense, meaning it's like a little bit of lockstep because we're going through a server now. So obviously everything's getting resolved in one place, which is a little bit more like a lockstep sort of thing. But it's also very asynchronous in the sense that what the client sees is sort of just trying to represent what it got from the server in some way. So could you talk a little bit about how you decided to do that, and was that informed a lot by sort of the experience with Warcraft, Diablo, Starcraft?
Right. So, you know, in Guild Wars, what happens is the server is authoritative for any important decisions, like where players are actually located, who owns which items, but clients do their best to model that in a way that seems seamless to users. So if I start walking, I don't have to go and ask the server, hey, is it okay if I walk over here? I already know all the collision information that's local to my system. I know where all the players are, and I know where all the objects in the world are. And so I can effectively perform pathfinding around those things. And if I bump into a wall, my local client will tell me, you know, back up a little bit, or, you know, you can't interpenetrate that wall. And, you know, I'm telling the server the whole time while I'm doing this, and the server's telling me what is actually true. So it can provide modifications. Okay. So if there were a bunch of people standing in my way, and I didn't quite know that that was true yet because they all sort of formed a wall right before
really
I kind
quickly,
of passed through, then, on my system, I might actually have to teleport back a little bit. But by and large, the rate of communication that you have with the server is high enough that you don't see those artifacts.
Okay.
But if you did, then the server just says, nope, I'm telling the truth, you have to move back.
Okay, so basically you sort of have a model where the client side is effectively running the game as much as it can run the game, and it's getting amount to corrections from the server as to, like, hey, yeah, you moved there, and I understand you drew that, but that was wrong, so, you know, move the guy back and, like, correct this sort of state, that sort of thing?
That's right. Or, you know, if you want to pick up an item, then what happens is you initiate the pickup request, and now you have an animation sequence that, like, takes a while to get done, so that the likelihood is that the round trip to the server has already elapsed. So, it's not like you pick up something instantaneously and it disappears, and it's like, oh, wait, you didn't get it. It takes a while, and, like, it could disappear before you pick up the object.
And how does that sort of thing, like, what's it like programming with that understanding in general? Like, do you find that that's a completely new process every time,
yes,
or is there a certain systemic nature to that programming? Like, do I have to think about it when I write the code to pick up the object, or is there more of a system that I did? Like, can you give a little bit of a perspective on how that works when I'm writing the code that's different from if I wasn't doing networking?
Yeah, so there's two things that I think are really helpful. One is to model everything as if it takes a minute to do each action.
Okay.
But, you know, like a ridiculous amount of round trip time or an hour, right? Because you start to think about the problem differently, right? It's like, well, I have to ask the server something. Well, every time I do that, it takes a minute round trip. And you start thinking about, like, oh, well, there's a lot of failure cases in there. Somebody could pick it up in that interval of time. So what am I going to do about that? And so it helps think about problems differently. The other is that you should inject simulated latency in your servers. And in fact, you should not run servers locally, in your office. Like, since most people are doing cloud-based games these days, that's not so much of an issue.
Yeah.
But even then, like, look at your servers far away, or if you have the code budget for it, then go put in simulated latency so that, and especially simulated jitter.
So the latency changes over time. Like, sometimes it's really quick, sometimes it's really long.
That's right. So a minimum of 200 milliseconds. Like, for the last game I worked on, we were using 250 to 500 milliseconds.
Okay.
So there was a lot of jitter in there.
Okay.
And that really helped, because you could feel, like, when the problem showed up.
I see.
Like, you know, if you click on a button and then nothing happens, like, hey, I think I need to, you know, the dialogue, the user interaction first off has to change. Like when I click a button, something should happen on the local system that indicates that I've accomplished that action. And then, you know, and like, you know, the dialogue changes now, like I'm trying to do something else.
Yeah.
And that way, you know, you don't have this stall where the client feels unresponsive.
So you would say that pretty much all of the code that's gameplay, you know, user-facing kinds of code at that point, pretty much all gets written with the network in mind. It's not really a separate thing where, you know, like for example in the Warcraft one, where you could almost imagine it being separate, two separate systems that don't really have to think that hard about each other. In this case, it's like, no, if you're a gameplay coder on this thing, you need to think about how that works, and that's just part of your day-to-day writing the code. Kind of
absolutely.
Thing. Okay. So let's see here. Yeah. Oh man, we need like another hour. So I guess I'll just quickly mention some of these things that you sort of said before, and you can see if maybe you can give a little bit of background here. So some of the things that you talked about, like in the email that you sent me, was like things we could talk about. You sort of talked about stuff like hacking and encryption and these sorts of things, and peer-to-peer versus server as like sort of, and then there was like you know, OS choice for you know, were you going to be Linux or Windows for hosting the server and all these sorts of things. So I guess my sort of broad question on that stuff is, there's a tremendous amount of new things you kind of have to think about if you want to do one of these games. Mm-hmm. Is there a particular resource, like, I don't know if maybe, like, you said you did a talk on one of these at one point, but, like, has anyone compiled sort of, like, things you should think about for your network game from some experts that kind of just go through, like, you know, it's not trying to tell you how everything needs to do, but it's bringing up all of the points, so you know you should think about all these things, because there were things on that list that I'd never even heard of before, right? So,
yeah.
Where would you start?
I couldn't point you to a specific blog or a book, but yeah. They do exist out there.
Okay.
And you just have to look for like game network programming, and
okay.
Like the issues do get raised.
Okay.
I mean, I think the biggest thing to be aware of is that whatever you create will be hacked.
Okay.
Because some people really enjoy the process of hacking, and so their game is you know, different from what you think you're selling.
Right. Right.
You know, just like some people like to grief. Like if you don't take griefing into account in your game, and it can be griefing your players, or it can be, you know, griefing you, the game operator. Right. Like when they take down your database.
Yeah.
For fun.
Yeah.
So like you have to think about rate limiting so that people can't try and do too much stuff at one time. You have to think about like the interaction model so that I can't get my guild together and we can all like attack you at one time with whisper messages and like push you off the internet.
I see.
You know, like you don't want to expose other players' IP addresses because, you know, in the old days, like I could send you the ping of death and kill your computer. The ping of death. I would send you an ICMP packet that would cause your Windows computer to crash. good stuff. How many players can you do that to today?
Yeah.
You know, like for example, we had a bug in the Guild Wars chat system at one point where we had these color codes that you could send along, but it wasn't perfectly validated. And so there's a color code that you could use that would, if you sent that color code, it would cause clients to crash.
Okay.
And so all of a sudden we started seeing like this like weird effects in our concurrency graph, and we would get alerts like, you know, something's going wrong, like lots of players are disconnecting, like our concurrency isn't stable. And we're also getting lots of crash reports. You have to have really good crash reporting for your game, right? So we'd see stack dumps of what was going on, and we were able to immediately look at it and go, well, look, the text processor is crashing. And so, like, we were able to figure out really quickly, somebody's sending data that's not valid, patch the game, 5 minutes later, we have a new build of the game out and the problem's fixed.
Okay.
Right, so that's, again, where iteration speed is really important. But, like, in literally everything you do, you have to think about the griefing and hacking aspects of it.
Yeah, because that's something that happens with network games. It really just doesn't happen anywhere else. Because if someone wants to hack their own game that they're playing single player, that's just fine, right? It's like there's no problem. But once you do network, you kind of open this whole.
Yeah, and even more than that, it's the responsibility of the programmers and designers. There is no legal recourse you have, right? Because the players could be living overseas or
right.
They could be underage, and so you can't stop
right.
them. So like the worst hacker we ever had in Guild Wars was like this 15-year-old kid named Pablo from France. And you know, like
Pablo from France.
We were able to identify him, and like we'd talk to his parents from time to time. But he never stopped.
How does that phone call go?
Yeah,
we'd really like little Pablo to stop taking down the Guild Wars server.
The problem is he was making too damn much money.
Okay.
So, you know, like he could sell items online. But the thing is we started watching him really closely and watching what his interactions with the game were.
Okay.
And we were able to identify bugs before he could really take advantage of them in a big way.
Okay. So I think we're just about out of time. So before we finish, I wanted to leave time for you. Told me you walked up here right before you were gonna start talking, and you said you wanted to say something about how do I get a job in the game industry? Because I had asked Mike about that. You had something you want to say, so we've got time.
Sure.
What did you want to say?
So, I mean, it's the number one question I get asked, so I figured rather than, like, everybody rushing down here, like, afterwards and hitting up all of us about how to get a job, I'd talk about what I think are the right things to do. You know, number one, I mean, I think the game industry is great because I've worked here for so many years, but I think, like, the one thing that people really need to have is demonstrable passion. And so passion is an excitement for stuff. I mean, it sort of relates to the curiosity that Mike was talking about. But demonstrable means that you have something that you can show. And it doesn't have to be a game, but it can be like, here's some code that I wrote that wasn't just for a class project or something. Or if you're a designer, like, here's this level I designed in, you know, whatever, Half-Life 2, like my own level that I did that nobody else participated in at all. And look at all these cool things I did and I can talk about. And it's great stuff that you can bring to you and talk about in the interview that shows that, you know, you haven't just done your schoolwork. I've interviewed tons of people, and they always say, not all of them, but like a bunch of people will say, well, you know, I was so busy with school, I just didn't really have time to do extracurricular activities like writing code.
Yeah.
It's like, bullshit. You know, we all have a certain amount of hours in the day, and we just choose what we want to do, and it could be watching TV or hanging out with friends or whatever, but if you're really passionate and you want to be successful at something, you know, when you're early in your career... Nice. Then, you know, you have to find a way to demonstrate that. So I think that really helps a lot. And you can also contribute to other people's projects, but I think that it's harder to demonstrate, like, well, this is what I did. Looking at hiring, lots of people have tried programming tests and whiteboard tests and things, but unlike the financial industry, past performance is a predictor of future success.
Okay.
And so the best way to hire is to look back at what somebody's done in the past, because that is the best predictor of what they will do in the future beyond any other thing that you can do.
Okay.
So demonstrate that you've done something.
Okay.
I also like coding interviews are really hard. Like just about any company you go to, like any bigger company is gonna have a really hard coding test. They're gonna grill you all day long. There's a great book for this, it's called Cracking the Coding Interview. And if you can just solve every problem in that book, you'll get a job anywhere you want. And so like, it's funny, but like people go to college for, you know, 4 years or something like that. And then they're like, well, maybe I'll study a little bit for the interview. No, like the interview is the most critical thing you can do to get a job at the place that you want. So treat it like it's a college course and put like a month into that book and solve every single problem in the book, right? And then you'll get a job anywhere.
I guess I didn't know that there was such a book. Would these be applicable to game companies even though? I mean,
absolutely, yeah.
Really, okay.
All the stuff is the kind of questions that Amazon, Google, Facebook, Microsoft ask these days.
But what about companies,
For example, the companies I've worked at too. Like, you know,
really?
ArenaNet, I wrote the coding test there, and it's you know, some of the problems are very similar to things that
okay.
I asked.
So you think it kind of does map well even across the board?
Yeah. Like, you know, the kind of stuff we did, reverse a linked list in place.
Oh, okay.
Singly linked list in place, right?
Okay.
You know, stuff like that is really common.
Okay. Well, I think that's it. Thank you so much for talking with us, Pat. That was that was fantastic. I wish we had
Thank
more
you.
Time. And we'll have to find some way of convincing you to like come on Handmade Hero sometime and go through these like one day at a time for us here. Seriously?
Yep.
Dude, we got to do that then, because like I said, I get that asked that all the time, and it would be awesome. It would be totally awesome if you would. That'd be great.